Interested in the forces shaping our world? The Council on Foreign Relations has you covered. For those who like to look ahead, dive into The World Next Week, hosted by Bob McMahon and Carla Ann Robbins.
We were not forecasting anything about Russian domestic upheaval, and yet that has been the story of the week.
These were scorpions going after each other in a bottle.
And for those who want to go beyond the headlines, join Jim Lindsay as he opens up the president's inbox.
What should U.S. policy do?
The approach towards China, it's enough to make me question bipartisanship.
And finally, join me, Gabrielle Sierra, on Why It Matters, as my guests and I bring some of the world's most compelling stories home to you.
Do you feel good about where we're heading with AI?
Maybe we need to invent a new word here, which kind of is a combination of frightened and excited.
I'm
excited.
So what are you waiting for?
For the world next week.
The President's Inbox.
And Why It Matters. We'll see you soon.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
When U.S. funding for allies becomes a political fight in Washington, Ukraine falls victim to a budget battle but is counting on the U.S. to come through.
Europeans and other countries are providing support, but the United States is by far the largest provider of military support.
Also today, Nobel Prizes for those who got COVID vaccines swiftly across the finish line, but mRNA technology has been in the works for a long time.
Built on the shoulders of giants, built on the shoulders of enormous amounts of research that has taken place for decades.
I'm Marco Werman. Another important scientific announcement today, a promising vaccine against malaria. Without it, the numbers are staggering.
That's 1,000 children a day dying in Africa, and we need to have a new tool, and that's what this new, highly effective, very available vaccine does.
All that and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. We begin today with a simple premise that certain scientific discoveries end up saving countless human lives. Two stories today illustrate that. In a moment, a critical breakthrough in the battle against malaria. First, though, in Stockholm, the winners of the Nobel Prize in Medicine were announced. Early this morning, scientist Katalin Karikó received what would turn out to be the most important call of her career.
I was sleeping. And actually, my husband picked up the phone.
The caller let Karikó know that she and fellow scientist Drew Weissman had clinched this year's Nobel Prize for their work on messenger RNA vaccines. Those vaccines use a genetic code to tell the body's cells to produce proteins. It's a revolutionary type of immunization that helped limit the impact of COVID-19, saving millions of lives. Karikó grew up in Hungary and resettled in the U.S. in the 1980s. She struggled to get her mRNA research funded here, as she explained to a Nobel Prize staffer.
I did all of these experiments, actually, with my own hands. I was 58 years old. I was still, feeding cells.
Colleagues describe Karikó as obsessed with the concept of messenger RNA. To find out why that research has been so important, we reached out to Dr. Michael Mina. He's a leading epidemiologist and the chief science officer at EMED.
Most vaccines, inside of the vaccines, are actually proteins or the structures of the pathogens or the viruses that we might want to protect ourselves against. And these proteins or structures are actually hard to build. Sometimes we just take a virus and we kill it and we put it into a vaccine, and that's kind of what the vaccine is made of. But that type of vaccine is not exactly fast to make. It's not easily reproducible across the world. And an mRNA vaccine takes an entirely different approach to it. It is actually giving the body blueprints of what to make. And then the body actually goes and builds the structures out of those blueprints. And those blueprints are called mRNA.
So if DNA is a giant blueprint, what does mRNA take from it and how does it like copy and paste it to the cell that uses it to build a protein? Can you explain that in simple terms?
Absolutely. So you could think of DNA as kind of the big master blueprint. mRNA is kind of the final blueprint that's been checked over, proofread multiple times before it actually goes and starts being built off of. So the mRNA is really the last and most critical blueprint that the body looks at before it actually starts going to work and building whatever that blueprint is telling it to build. Just to be clear, mRNA is in all of us. It is in every single cell of our body naturally. And the use of it in vaccines is just a very clever and, you know, has been a long road to figure out, again, how to use our own body as machinery and the types of molecules our own body already makes for our own uses and for our own defenses.
Gotcha. Now, Carrico and Weissman were recognized for their groundbreaking findings. What exactly was their contribution to the science?
There were many, but the most important one was how to insert mRNA into a human in a way that the human doesn't immediately think it's a foreign invader and destroy it. What they discovered was a way to cloak the RNA in all different little molecules that the body normally makes. And they figured out what exactly those cloaks look like and how to put them on RNA in a way that our body actually does not see it as foreign, but rather sees it as something that's supposed to be there.
You know, from a layperson's perspective, it sounds so mechanical, just at a really, really nano level.
That's the amazing thing about biology. It all goes by rules. They're very complicated and complex, but at the end of the day, we're structures, and we get built by little machines inside of us called proteins and enzymes, and they're all just reading these blueprints, these massive numbers of blueprints in our body, and going to work.
Now, I mentioned Carrico's near obsession with mRNA. You took us back, Michael, to her and Weissman's work to 2005. So lest anyone see this Nobel Prize-winning work happening overnight, set the record straight. This mRNA technique had been in development for decades, right? Long before the coronavirus pandemic.
Absolutely. The coronavirus pandemic made the world aware of mRNA vaccines. But actually, the attempts to create vaccines using mRNA and interest in mRNA as a tool has gone back to the 70s. For many, many years, the first big hurdles were how do you even get mRNA into the body, not even worrying about how to preserve it yet. And that was done in little liposomes or like little fat globules you could stick mRNA into, and the body, it would be a good vehicle to get it into the body. And over the ensuing decades, their work was, you know, completely dedicated to figuring out how to manipulate mRNA outside of a body so that we could actually get it inside. And so this has been a very, very long road. And then really, it was just in the last decade or so when the notion of mRNA vaccines really started to take off, built on the shoulders of giants, built on the shoulders of, you know, enormous amounts of research that has taken place for decades.
Dr. Minow, what sort of future uses of mRNA are you looking forward to or you think show promise?
mRNA, because of its very nature, can start to be used for cancer vaccines. We could really drive, if somebody has a tumor and we want to instruct that person's immune system to recognize that tumor as a foreign enemy, we could actually potentially create vaccines using mRNA that educate the body to see that tumor and to say, hey, these are some mutations or some weird proteins that this person's tumor has. Tell the body what it looks like, teach the body about that tumor. And then all of a sudden the immune system goes and does its thing and starts to treat the tumor like a foreign invader and could potentially clear it. Those trials have already been underway. We're seeing a lot of really important promises in the notion of cancer vaccines, and mRNA technology and these vaccines are absolutely going to be a critical player in that long-term hunt for how to get rid of cancer.
Dr. Michael Minow is a leading epidemiologist and the chief science officer at EMED. He's been speaking with us about mRNA vaccines, a revolutionary technology recognized in today's Nobel Prize in Medicine that went to Carolyn Carrico and Drew Weissman. Michael, thank you very much for being here.
Very happy to.
The other good news in the field of science and medicine, the World Health Organization made an historic announcement today. 2 years after announcing the first ever vaccine against malaria, now this.
It gives me great pleasure to announce that WHO is recommending a second vaccine called R21 Matrix M to prevent malaria in children at risk of the disease.
That's the WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus this morning in Geneva. To get a better understanding of R21, we reached out to the scientist who led the research team developing the vaccine. Professor Sir Adrian Hill is director of the Jenner Institute and a professor of vaccinology at the University of Oxford in the UK. This would seem to be a really important milestone in the long history of combating malaria, Professor. What exactly is R21 and how does it work?
R21 is a vaccine that has in it part of the malaria parasite. It's called the circumsporozoite protein. It coats the malaria parasite that the mosquito injects under the skin. And it's been a target of malaria vaccinologists for decades. The challenge has been to produce enough antibodies with a particular vaccine type to get this to really work and work well. So we're really excited that today marks really the culmination of at least 30 years of research trying to get a malaria vaccine that has good efficacy in preventing malaria in African children, which are the main target population.
Right. And when you say good efficacy, we're talking 75% effective. Just like what that means to a population, say in India or a part of Africa where malaria is a real problem, what does that look like?
Yeah. So if 1,000 children were going to get an episode of malaria and you vaccinated that population, only 250 would get a malaria episode. So you're preventing 3/4 of the episodes of malaria. And that's super important because this is a disease that kills 620,000 people a year, mainly children, mainly in Africa. And, you know, we've not seen an improvement in that number over the last 7 years.
Yeah, so for that cohort of 250 in that population you just mentioned who would get malaria after the vaccine, would it reduce symptoms in those individuals?
Well, it probably reduces a lot of episodes because, you know, in some of the places we've been testing this vaccine, children get 3 or 4 episodes a year. So what would happen in their case is you'd get down to 1 episode. And yes, that episode itself might be attenuated by the vaccine because fewer parasites get through.
So getting us to this moment has been just years of research and clinical work. In your own career, Adrian, what was it like to learn that this vaccine had reached 75% effectiveness?
You know, that was such an unlikely thing to happen, that when WHO came out in about 2014 and said, we want a vaccine with 75% effectiveness, people sort of scratched their heads and said, look, that's just aspirational. Is it really going to happen? And suddenly we have, you know, less than 10 years later, in 2021, the vaccine trial with 77% efficacy, that's this vaccine. And here we have that confirmed in a phase 3 trial. So fantastically exciting. And it also points the way to how we can do better with similar technologies to improve the next generation of malaria vaccines, leading not just to controlling the disease, but actually eradicating this parasite.
Today, the WHO announced the R21 news, but also another vaccine already in use, RTSS, they say will have similar effectiveness. But some reports suggest RTSS has much lower efficacy, 36% versus 75% for R21. What does the science say about this?
So the numbers we have so far suggest that, yes, R21 is in the mid-70s. In terms of efficacy, RTSS, as well as we can compare, looks like the mid-50s. Or thereabouts. But the point being made today was they had never been compared head-to-head. But we would point out that R21 has been in the 70% efficacy range, both in human volunteer studies with deliberate malaria infection, which is often done in the malaria field, in phase 2 trials in West Africa, and now in a much larger trial across a diversity of settings within sub-Saharan Africa. So we're consistently seeing this high efficacy, which has not been seen with any vaccine previously.
So what happens now? How does this powerful new vaccine against malaria reach the people who live in malaria-endemic places, that last mile?
Yeah, well, the really good news is in many of these countries, even though they're very much low-income countries, the uptake rate of vaccines is better than in many parts of the rich world. For example, some of these children are getting 10 vaccines. So starting off on the day of birth with BCG, very often the mothers will come back for newer vaccines like the pneumococcal vaccine that is very cost effective. And now we're pleased to be able to add a malaria vaccine at 5, 6, and 7 months of age. So it's not a question of would mothers tolerate that or could we make this happen in low-income parts of Africa. It is happening today.
Professor Adrian Hill is director of the Jenner Institute and a professor of vaccinology at the University of Oxford in the UK. He was telling us about R21, the new malaria vaccine just approved for use by the World Health Organization. Sir Adrian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
One final vaccine note for you. Actually, this one is for the birds. In France, 60 million ducks are getting vaccinated this year in an effort to deal with bird flu. German broadcaster Deutsche Welle reports that France's Department of Agriculture is footing 85% of the bill for a program that will cost more than $100 million. It's Europe's only mass vaccination campaign against avian influenza, giving two shots to ducklings on farms that have more than 250 birds. There are currently no bird flu outbreaks in France, and backers of the program want to keep it that way. Some farmers are critical of the plan and told Deutsche Welle that their customers don't really want to eat meat from vaccinated ducks. Just ahead on the show, the knock-on effect for Ukraine from this weekend's budget deal in Washington. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For now, crisis averted. Congress managed to pass a stopgap spending bill at the 11th hour. So no shutdown of the federal government, but dodging that came at a significant cost. $6 billion in aid for Ukraine's war effort was left out of this compromise deal. President Biden said on Sunday that the U.S. will not walk away from its commitments.
We cannot, under any circumstance, allow American support for Ukraine to be interrupted.
In Ukraine, Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said he was confident about receiving future American support.
We don't feel that the U.S. support has been shattered because the United States understands that what is at stake in Ukraine.
For more on this political disagreement in Washington, we turn to Mark Kansian. He's a retired colonel with the U.S. military and is a senior advisor with the CSIS International Security Program. Mark, explain for us how funding for Ukraine got worked out of the budget that Congress passed over the weekend. I mean, for the most part, this money has had bipartisan support since Russia began its full-scale invasion over a year and a half ago. What happened?
Well, it does have strong bipartisan support. It's come up in the summer, but the problem is that there's a small group of Republicans who are able to withhold approval for what goes to the floor. And they were able to push the Ukrainian money out, even though if it went to the floor, it would likely pass. In fact, would likely pass overwhelmingly.
Now, the resources going to Ukraine's military from the U.S. amount to 5% of the total U.S. Defense budget, which is why many Democrats have said it's a small price to pay to keep adventurous authoritarianism in check around the globe. How surprised are you that Ukraine funding fell victim to deal-making in Congress?
Well, I'm not surprised because there has been opposition both from the progressive left and increasingly from the populist right. Although they don't have a majority, it's a real faction and a growing faction. So the fact that they were able to hold this up is not a surprise. What we do hope is that the leadership will find a way to get the bill to the floor so it can be voted on and, I say, almost certainly pass overwhelmingly.
Mark, we've read reporting that supporters of Ukraine in the Senate urged the Biden White House to move money around from other sources to fill the gap, and the administration says it doesn't have any leeway to do that. Are there budget maneuvers that the president can make to keep streams of funding going to Ukraine regardless of what Congress does or decides?
I mean, there are ways that the administration can use existing funds for Ukraine. Some of it may have to be reprogrammed. Some of it can be done with existing authorities. The problem is that they will be cutting into ongoing programs. You'll be cutting programs that Pentagon had been counting on. That will, over time, endanger U.S. global capabilities, and particularly the U.S. stance in the competition with China. I think that's where you'll hear the Pentagon start to raise concerns.
Yeah, so this stopgap funding measure keeps the government running through November 17th. What does this holdup mean for Ukraine in the short term?
Well, in the short term, there's enough money for probably a couple of weeks maybe to keep the flow of aid going. Some of it's going to run out pretty quickly, though. Support for services like training and intelligence and cyber will run out probably within a week or two. The drawdown of equipment goes longer because there's some authorization there. The humanitarian money will run out. The support for the training government will run out, could be sustained. Now, the president could also make a decision that he's going to take this money out of the existing budget. In other words, instead of asking for additional money to support Ukraine, he could take it out of the Pentagon's budget. That would work for a short period of time, maybe a couple of weeks, but the Pentagon would start to object.
So how will all this translate on the battlefield as Ukraine continues to look to take back more territory on the front line?
If the support disappears, it'll have a major impact on the battlefield. The Europeans and other countries are providing support, but the United States is by far the largest provider of military support. Without that support, the Ukrainian resistance would weaken and eventually crumble. It's vital for keeping the Ukrainian armed forces in the field.
Politically and symbolically, Mark, how much do you think this hurts U.S.-Ukrainian relations?
Well, it will certainly make the Ukrainians nervous, and they've already been nervous. The, what you might call the peace party has been gaining strength throughout the course of the war. Here we're seeing it dramatically from the populist right, but in Europe you see the same thing with the populist right and the progressive left. The great fear is a forever war, you know, that is a war that goes on for a long time, at great fiscal cost and a great cost in lives and property. The Ukrainians are willing to keep fighting, but this peace party keeps expanding. A lot will depend on the counteroffensive and whether the Ukrainians can show some progress.
Yeah, talk more about the peace party and what that represents.
The peace party is really two elements. It's the progressive left, which is concerned both about the money being diverted from social programs and about the suffering that the war imposes, and from the populist right, which also objects to the money, and some of which have some sympathy maybe for Putin. They've always been there, but over time, you can see those numbers rising in the polls.
So with elements on the far right and the Peace Party kind of pushing for this war to kind of wind up, how long do you think American support for Ukraine's war against Russia can continue?
If Zelensky can convince Americans that he has a path to victory and that we need to keep supporting him, but he will get there, I think that Americans will be willing to pay the price. But if it looks like there isn't a path to victory, this may just go on indefinitely. That argument's going to be harder and harder to make.
Finally, Mark, I'm curious to know how optimistically you feel today about U.S. support for Ukraine compared to, say, a year ago.
Well, clearly, we're in a more difficult place. The counteroffensive, which began with, you know, such great hopes, is not making the kind of progress that everyone had hoped for. You know, the way forward is not as clear. On the other hand, the fundamental issues have not changed. Russia has still invaded a neighbor, and the impetus for our initial support has not changed.
Mark Kansian is a retired colonel with the U.S. military and a senior advisor with the CSIS International Security Program. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Inside this whole budget debate in Washington is another story that we cover closely on The World, and that's the situation on the U.S.-Mexico border. Republicans in Congress say they want more funding for border security. They've also talked about making it more difficult for some migrants to claim asylum. Senators talked about adding $6 billion in funding for security at the border, but that was also left out of the stopgap budget. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says that in the debate over the federal budget, funding for Ukraine and funding for the border are connected, and his own priority is clear.
The priority for me is America and our borders. Now, I support being able to make sure Ukraine has the weapons that they need, but I firmly support the border first.
McCarthy laid out his stance yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan.
More Americans are dying on our border than Americans are dying in Ukraine.
So you are explicitly right now linking any Ukraine aid vote to a border bill. It won't be a standalone Ukraine bill.
I am telling you that the American border matters, and that is our priority to make sure we secure that.
So that has to move first.
I'm going to make sure that the weapons are provided for Ukraine, but they're not going to get some big package if the border is not secure.
That was House Speaker Kevin McCarthy speaking with Margaret Brennan on CBS's Face the Nation. We'll continue to follow both of these stories as they develop. An assassination of a former prime minister last year in Japan, connections to the controversial Unification Church. Now Japan's government looks set to revoke the status of the group as a lawful religious organization.
It's very simple. Japanese government decision is right.
Many agree. They say the Unification Church is really a dangerous cult. That's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Turkish warplanes struck Kurdish militants in northern Iraq on Sunday. This followed a suicide bombing in Turkey's capital, Ankara. That incident just outside the Ministry of the Interior. Two police officers were injured when one attacker appeared to set off an explosion. A second man was shot and killed. The Kurdistan Workers' Party, also known as the PKK, claimed responsibility for the bombing. The World's Duri Biskaran is in Istanbul and is across the latest. Duri, first tell us what happened and what we are learning from investigators about the attack in Ankara.
Yeah, I mean, Turkish officials say the attackers actually carjacked a van in the city of Kayseri and drove all the way to Ankara to carry this out. They killed the driver in the process. He was just buried today, leaving behind a wife and infant. Surveillance camera footage shows the van stopping just outside the entrance gates to the Ministry of the Interior, and you can see two men get out. There's a shootout with guards at the entrance, and then a big explosion. Photos of the scene afterwards show a Russian-made rocket launcher on the ground. Analysts say that could have come from Russian-backed groups in Syria. Fortunately, this attack happened on a Sunday morning, so no one was around, except for two policemen who were injured but survived. Turkey then retaliated with airstrikes in northern Iraq on Sunday evening, and then dozens of people were arrested overnight in Istanbul and another western Turkish city.
Now, the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, has not been very active in Turkey in recent years, so why now?
The PKK has waged an insurgency in Turkey since the 1970s. Initially, they hoped to win an autonomous Kurdish territory, but the group's leadership has said their goals have evolved to protecting the cultural and political rights of Kurdish people in Turkey. They're listed as a terrorist group by Turkey, the US, the EU, and other Western nations. When the PKK claimed responsibility for this past Sunday's attack, for yesterday's attack, they said it was in retaliation for Turkish military movements against them and the oppression of Kurdish people. Berkay Mandaraji is a senior analyst for the crisis group, and he doesn't see this as a new chapter of violence between the Turkish government and the PKK. He says the PKK is probably trying to demonstrate that it's capable of these attacks, particularly as a recruiting tool.
The two sides have been locked in this cycle of violence, which is deepening even further, and this attack is probably going to create even more escalation down the line.
He sees the PKK as feeling cornered in Syria and Iraq.
Now, this attack happened during just hours before an opening ceremony for the Turkish parliament after its summer recess. That feels noteworthy. How did the government react?
During the reopening of parliament, which went ahead as scheduled, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan made a speech.
Etkisiz hale getirildiği eylem terörün son çırpınışlarıdır.
He said the attack was, quote, the last struggle of terrorism, and that Turkey would continue its fight until the last terrorist inside or outside the country is eliminated. And he called for the parliament to start writing a new constitution, which he says would strengthen the country's democracy. Critics believe a new constitution could further centralize his power, as well as curtailing rights for the LGBTQ community, who he's been recently targeting.
Now, in response to this attack in Ankara, Turkey goes after Kurdish militants based in northern Iraq. That happened yesterday, as I said. It's not the first time Turkey reacts that way either when tensions flare up with the PKK. What can you tell us, Duri, about those airstrikes on Sunday?
Right. I mean, the Turkish military regularly carries out these airstrikes in the Kandil Mountains on PKK strongholds. It's part of this escalation between the two. In a statement, the Turkish Ministry of National Defense said that these strikes targeted caves, bunkers, and shelters used by PKK militants. The statement says that the maximum amount of ammunition was used and that many terrorists were neutralized. That's a blanket term that the Turkish government uses to say that people were either killed or imprisoned, and they claimed that all precautions were taken to prevent the loss of civilian life.
There is something else going on that's related to this latest news with the PKK. The Turkish parliament is expected to ratify Sweden's bid to join NATO soon. And a big sticking point that we've been reporting on has been Erdogan's complaint that Sweden was giving safe harbor to members of the PKK. So what could this attack in Turkey mean for that vote?
Right. I mean, one of Turkey's big reasons for blocking Sweden from joining NATO is that it refused to extradite people accused of being PKK members. And Erdogan also didn't like the fact that Swedish authorities have allowed pro-PKK demonstrations in Stockholm, the latest being this past weekend. Paul Levin directs the Institute for Turkish Studies at Stockholm University, and he says this Sunday's attack could affect Sweden's chances of joining NATO.
I think that regardless of the PKK, which has claimed the attack, the PKK's true intentions, the effects, I think, will be, from a Swedish perspective, very, very negative on our prospects for ratification.
He says it's just going to be more difficult politically to get the Turkish parliament to vote on this.
The world's Duri Buscaran joining us from Istanbul, helping us understand the aftermath of the suicide bombing in Ankara this weekend. Duri, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Now to a prison escape story with international dimensions. In Venezuela, government security forces recently seized control of one of the country's most notorious prisons. A transnational criminal gang was operating from inside it. Venezuela's government claims to have dismantled the gang, but their leader was somehow able to flee the prison, and now countries across South America are searching for him. The world's TV Size Zaya has our story.
On September 20th, thousands of soldiers and police officers stormed Venezuela's Tocoron prison, which is one of the most violent in the country. And what they found inside is wild. A nightclub, illegal drug shops, swimming pools, a professional baseball field, children's playgrounds, and a zoo with monkeys and flamingos. They also found that hundreds of relatives of the inmates, including children, were also living there. What they didn't find was the prison's most dangerous inmate, Hector Guerrero, known as El Niño Guerrero or Guerrero's Kid.
He is the head, or certainly one of the heads, of Venezuela's largest homegrown criminal structure, the Tren de Aragua.
Jeremy McDermott is with Inside Crime, a think tank that researches organized crime in the Americas. He says the Tren de Aragua cartel has profited from the exodus of migrants traveling not to the United States, but to countries south of Venezuela.
It's one of the few groups in Latin America that went transnational, not through the drug trade, but through human smuggling. And following the exodus of more than 7 million Venezuelans who have fled their country.
It's not just smuggling. They also engage in extortion, kidnapping, drug trafficking, murder for hire, sexual exploitation, and human trafficking. Guerrero was also the prison kingpin at Tocoron. This is, of course, thanks to the complicity of Venezuelan prison authorities, according to Humberto Prado, the head of a prison watchdog organization in Venezuela. He says self-governing prisons are the norm in his country.
Y se mantiene lo que esa situación donde las cárceles están en manos de los presos y no en manos de las propias autoridades.
He says the Venezuelan government lets criminals run the prisons. Health, safety, food, it's all controlled by inmates.
Porque los presos que mantienen el poder dentro de las cárceles, si usted no se apega a las reglas de ellos, se muere.
He says inmates have to pay taxes to the most powerful criminals inside the prison. And if they don't, they can be killed. This has been an open secret for years. So why has the government decided to seize this prison now? Rona Rizquez is a Venezuelan journalist who wrote a book about Venezuela's Tocoron prison.
El gobierno de Venezuela está en una búsqueda, en una necesidad de legitimarse internacionalmente.
Rizquez says the Venezuelan government wants to improve relations with other Latin American countries. Colombia, Peru, and Chile have demanded publicly that this prison be dismantled. Jeremy McDermott from Inside Crime points to an additional reason.
Venezuela is gearing up for a presidential campaign. We've got the elections next year. And I think that Maduro is seeking to burnish his credentials a little, show that he's tough on crime, both nationally and internationally. So this is all part of a strategy to slightly clean up some of the darker aspects of his regime.
On the same day that the prison was dismantled, the United Nations released a report that details serious violations of human rights in Venezuela. The report outlines how Maduro's authoritarian regime has repressed dissidents through crimes against humanity. McDermott says it's very likely that the Venezuelan government negotiated with the prison leadership because several days before the prison was shut down, weapons, money, and people were moved out of the prison through underground tunnels.
This suggests, of course, that they had a long warning that the operation was coming, and that by the time the armed forces were deployed, Nino Guerrero and much of the leadership of the Tren de Aragua were long gone.
It's not clear where Nino Guerrero is now, but McDermott says it's a dangerous situation.
What we are worried about is an increase in Tren de Aragua operations and violence that might be the result of these leaders going into the field.
The international police agency Interpol has issued a red notice seeking Guerrero's capture, and governments across South America are hunting for him. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
For decades, we've heard about the Unification Church. Members of the church see themselves as part of a worldwide Christian movement sent by God to save mankind. Many others say the group is a dangerous cult. Either way, the government in Japan is ready to declare that the Unification Church, also known as the Moon Sect, can no longer operate, at least in Japan. This comes more than a year after the assassination of former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. He was killed by a man who hated Abe for supporting the religious sect. After Abe's killing, the Japanese public was shocked to learn that the controversial church had friends in high places, namely in Japan's ruling party. The World's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen has been following this story closely. Patrick, I understand this ruling on the church was not a big surprise in Japan. Back up a bit for us. Remind us how extensive the ties have been between the Unification Church in Japan and ex-Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
Yeah, very close. And before this killing, Marco, people didn't know the full extent of these connections. It wasn't that Shinzo Abe and the ruling party in Japan harbored the beliefs of the Moon Church, but they did protect the Moon Church from legal scrutiny so that the church's 100,000 followers in Japan would vote for them. And this has been a huge scandal for the last year in Japan. People really didn't know the extent of that until Shinzo Abe was murdered by a man, unemployed man, with a homemade shotgun in Japan. He said that the church had bilked his mother out of more than $600,000, and it ruined his family's life, and he had to take revenge. He couldn't shoot the Moon family. They're based in America, established by the Reverend Sung Myung Moon, but he went after Abe instead.
So what exactly is happening with the church now in Japan? Is it facing an outright ban?
Well, this decision is not final, but Japan's government is right on the cusp of banning the group from acting as a religious organization. So that means no tax-free status, no calling themselves a church, and they're branded as a malicious threat to public welfare. I talked to a professor who has studied the church, Yoshihide Sakurai, at Hokkaido University, and I asked him if this move by the Japanese government surprised him at all.
No surprise. It's a very simple Japanese government decision is right.
And he says the public outcry against the church is so strong that lots of people will appreciate this move by the government. But Professor Sakurai said when Japanese people see the fine details of the decision, they might not be so happy.
The problem will continue, I think. So they might be not happy.
The problem will continue, meaning the church could find a way to keep going.
So I'm wondering what this isolation of the church in Japan will mean for it elsewhere, Patrick. If the Unification Church is facing this ban in Japan, will it somehow manage to operate in new ways?
It's a major blow to the group as a worldwide organization for sure. In Japan, it will be banned as a church, but it could transform into a private tax-paying organization. And the hardcore believers, I've interviewed them, trust me, they are not going to bail on the church no matter what you call it. They believe the Moon family has a direct line to God. The church will say, give us money to save your ancestors from a hellish afterlife going 200 generations back. It's going to cost tens of thousands of dollars. They will pay. They have already paid. So moving forward, the Japanese government could at least tax those donations, but it is not going to make worshiping the Moon family illegal.
As you point out, though, Patrick, this is a global religious organization. It's been around a long time, has members in many countries, including here in the U.S., where the Moon family lives. So what impact is this potential ban in Japan going to have on the church worldwide?
It's pretty bad for the church. Japan, along with South Korea and the U.S., these are their three pillars. This is where all their followers are. But the church is in decline. You know, it was started in the 50s by Reverend Sungmyung Moon, a Korean man claiming to be the successor to Jesus Christ. He died 10 years ago. He left it to his wife, who calls herself God's only begotten daughter. I mean, Americans of a certain age might remember this couple on TV. They hung out with Richard Nixon and Bill Cosby. I'm not sure young Americans or young people in many parts of the world know about the Moons. They are struggling to recruit new members. So if the government in Japan hurts their bottom line, which it has, it will wound the organization while it's already pretty weak.
Interesting. The World's Patrick Wynn is based in Bangkok. Patrick, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
The fearsome Wagner mercenary group and its future. A lot of speculation in Russia and elsewhere about that. Wagner has played a central role in Russia's war in Ukraine. But in late August, as you'll recall, the group's top commander, Yevgeny Prigozhin, died in a plane crash. That was after a short-lived mutiny against Russia's military leadership earlier in the summer. Many observers assume that Prigozhin's death was engineered by the Kremlin. So what does come next for the Wagner group? The World's Daniel Hoffman joins me from Riga, the capital of Latvia. Daniel, late last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin held a meeting in Moscow with a former Wagner commander. What was significant about that meeting?
Putin met with Andrei Troshev, who used to be a close aide to Yevgeny Prigozhin, and as you said, an ex-Wagner commander. The meeting took place in Moscow, and bits of that conversation were broadcast on Russian state TV. Here Putin tells Troshev that he'll be tasked with forming volunteer units that can perform various combat tasks and that they'll be deployed in the zone of the special military operation. That's Ukraine. Now, the Kremlin stated that Troshev now works with the Russian Ministry of Defense. Part of the idea of the meeting was that Putin wants to show publicly that the Russian state now gained control over the Wagner mercenary group. However, at this point, it's still unclear what that's going to look like or how exactly the group will operate going forward.
So what do we know about this man, Andrei Troshev? Who is he and what's his background?
Troshev is a decorated veteran of the Russian military. He fought in Afghanistan and in the Second Chechen War, so he has a lot of combat experience. In 2012, after leaving the military, he joined the Wagner Group, and that was when Russia was beginning its military intervention in Syria. That's when Troshev took on a leadership role within the organization. So since then, for more than a decade now, he continued to serve within the ranks of Wagner under Yevgeny Prigozhin. However, according to media reports, Troshev and Prigozhin had a falling out earlier this summer around the time of the Wagner mutiny. So now if we fast forward to today, it looks like Troshev is being brought back into the fold.
Yeah, and there have been a lot of recent changes with these mercenaries, and I wonder what the current state of the Wagner group as a military force actually is.
Well, the short answer is that the organization's leadership is in flux, but aspects of it are continuing to work just like before. Marcel Plikta is a former analyst with the U.S. Department of Defense. He's now at the University of St. Andrews. Here's what he told me.
Despite the Kremlin's problems with Prigozhin, the Wagner model is somewhat resilient as a tool of Russian foreign policy. You know, you haven't seen Wagner leave Africa. You haven't seen Wagner leave Syria. For the most part, they've remained in place.
And they've remained in place because the Kremlin can't afford to stop the Wagner operation. The group makes the Russian state hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's another way for Russia to project power in Africa and the Middle East. Now, the appointment of Troshev is the Kremlin signaling that it's asserting control over part of the operation. Here's Plikta again.
This is very much Putin's guy and the Ministry of Defense's guy. And so that kind of shows that there's an interest, at the very top at least, reining in Wagner's autonomy.
And if we look ahead, the question is, will Troshev's appointment impact the situation in Ukraine? Will Wagner fighters be redeployed to the front lines? As of now, we don't know, but it certainly seems like that's Putin's goal.
The World's Daniel Hoffman in Riga, the Latvian capital, bringing us the latest on Russian mercenaries, the Wagner Group. Daniel, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Washington, D.C. is not just about politics. It also has a thriving international music scene, in part because so many people who settle there came from somewhere else. WAMU's Hector Alejandro Arzate introduces us to an ensemble that's bringing the sounds of cumbia to the nation's capital.
Isaías Guerrero is a percussionist for the band Cumbia Heights, a 10-person ensemble featuring the accordion, guitars, bongo, and trumpet, just to name a few of the instruments. They play cumbia, a highly danceable fusion of African rhythms, indigenous sounds, and European elements. Guerrero moved to the U.S. on a tourist visa when he was young, and has since become a DACA recipient. However, traveling back to his birth country of Colombia is still difficult. But despite being thousands of miles away, he says that nothing makes him feel closer to home than playing music from there.
Exacto, sí, es como un espacio seguro donde puedo, sí, celebrar mi tradición y compartirla con el mundo, ¿no? Y también, pues, un ritmo que cruza fronteras.
Since many Latin American countries have their own take on cumbia, co-founder and guitarist Fernando Hernandez says the group is blending the signature styles of their home countries, which also includes Mexico, Chile, Peru, and even the states of Texas and Louisiana, to create their neo-cumbia sound.
I feel like we hit a niche of the need for Latin music and live music in the city, because nobody was playing live after the pandemic. And we just had a really good timing.
Cumbia Heights has become known for their unique ability to play their own stuff and even remix Careless Whisper, which co-founder Tomás Monares says makes perfect sense for cumbia.
Somebody called cumbia once it's like an amoeba. Like it can grab other genres and turn it into part of its own. Es una la ameba de la cumbia.
While the band does put together really fun music and shows, they also care deeply about the origins of cumbia itself, which is over 3 centuries old and was born out of resistance from enslaved people in the Spanish colonies.
Entonces, el entender esa esencia de la cumbia.
Guerrero says it's important to understand the essence of cumbia, which was originated by African and indigenous people. So it's a big responsibility to be able to adapt it in the U.S. as immigrants. But that also brings a lot of joy for the spaces they've created. And Demetrio Baptiste, the band's trumpet player, says that music does have the power to create community.
You know, it doesn't matter what language you speak, you know. As long as you have that music to bring you together and that heartbeat, you always make it, baby.
Over the past 6 months, the band has grown from small outings to full-blown performances. They've also officially released their first single called Tumbado, which you're listening to right now. De las cosas que he pensado, pero yo sé que soy fino. Eso no me ha molestado, no. Cumbia Heights says they're working on an EP, which is scheduled to debut soon. For The World, I'm Hector Alejandro Arzate in Washington, D.C.
We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. As always, thank you for listening.